This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the top leader in Hong Kong apologizes for controversial legislation that set off huge protests in the global financial center. The bill would have allowed extraditions to mainland China, a move critics fear could be abused by Beijing for political aims. How far is China willing to go to limit Hong Kong's autonomy and civil liberties? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Backpedaling under mounting pressure, Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, indefinitely suspended the extradition bill, a bill which Beijing had strongly supported. However, she did not concede to the protesters' demand that it be withdrawn entirely, nor did she agree to resign, another demand of the protesters. On Sunday, June 16, approximately 2 million people out of a population of 7.4 million thronged the streets. It was an extraordinary display of people power in a city struggling to maintain its partial autonomy under the so-called One Country, Two Systems model, which has governed the relationship between communist mainland China and Hong Kong since the British relinquished control of the city to Beijing in 1997. In the run-up to Carrie Lam's partial capitulation, Hong Kong's security forces came under widespread criticism over their excessive use of tear gas and rubber bullets against the demonstrators, actions that prompted condemnation by pro-democracy activists, global human rights groups, and opposition lawmakers. Chief Executive Carrie Lam was widely criticized not only by the pro-democracy opposition in Hong Kong, but also more quietly by pro-Beijing politicians. They say she misread public opinion, mismanaged the issue, and provoked a political crisis that has damaged the city's international standing. Well, joining us to discuss the substance, symbolism, and ramifications of the Hong Kong protests are two distinguished regional analysts. Daniel Kleiman is a senior fellow and director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and that's a policy group based here in Washington, and Olivia Enos. She's a policy analyst who specializes in human rights in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, and that's a policy group also based here in Washington. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much having us.
Let me begin with Daniel Kleiman first. Daniel, let's talk about what triggered these massive protests. There was the bill to extradite people to China. Where did this come from? Talk about its genesis.
The actual genesis of this bill traces to a somewhat obscure case where a Hong Kong couple had traveled to Taiwan. Essentially, the boyfriend murdered his girlfriend in Taiwan, came back, and this was essentially justification then for the Hong Kong authorities to create or push this law. Currently, they don't have a relationship with Taiwan where they could essentially extradite the alleged murderer and essentially use this kind of obscure murder case to create a pretext for the extradition law. Interestingly, as these kind of protests became stronger, the government of Taiwan actually said they did not want to see an extradition of the alleged murderer even to Taiwan because this would cause a kind of encroachment on Hong Kong's own autonomy. So a kind of a obscure case becoming a pretext for this law.
Olivia Enos, feel free to add or subtract to anything that Daniel said. Why do you think the Hong Kong chief executive, who is strongly backed by Beijing, promoted this bill, and why did the protesters fear and detest this bill and prompted them to come out to the streets?
Yeah, I think that Chief Executive Carrie Lam really miscalculated when she allowed the extradition law to go forward. And I think that there's a lot of speculation that it was principally led by Beijing, but it seems like it actually did originate in Hong Kong, and that, of course, it would receive support from Beijing because it's in Beijing's interest to be able to extradite anyone at the drop of a hat. And I think this is really important context for folks to realize is that this doesn't just have implications for Hong Kongers. This has implications for the international businessmen and women that are there. In Hong Kong, there's an estimated 85,000 American businessmen alone serving there. And they could literally be extradited at the drop of a hat. And it's not only the business industry that would be affected, but the major concern is that individuals who are vocal advocates for freedom and are dissenters within Hong Kong, that they too could be extradited by Beijing. And there's precedent for this already. So I think there's strong concern. The protesters themselves have founded grounds for going out into the street. And I think it's truly miraculous the amount of progress that they've been able to make in a relatively short period of time.
Well, let's talk about that progress, Daniel Kleiman. For now, things have calmed down with this apology, almost an unprecedented move by the chief executive. She apologized, but she only temporarily suspended the bill. And the protesters are demanding that she withdraw it completely. They are so covetous of their relative freedoms vis-a-vis communist China. So will these moves mollify the protesters? What's at stake here?
So I think first, I mean, we should give the protesters enormous credit for what they've already achieved, which is quite impressive. At the same time, to me, this seems more like a tactical retreat by the Hong Kong authorities supported by Beijing, that if you look at kind of the longer term trend since the British handed over Hong Kong to mainland China, you've seen a kind of creeping erosion of Hong Kong's freedoms and autonomy. And so certainly if you look back at the umbrella movement or revolution that happened in 2014, where there was a push for a more kind of free and fair universal election of Hong Kong's chief executive, Beijing and its kind of proxies in Hong Kong held the line there. And so I think you'll see a tactical retreat. It's very noteworthy that this legislation has not been withdrawn. It's merely suspended. Carrie Lam, at least right now, is not resigning. And so I think China has shown itself, mainland China, to be fairly strategic, that when there's a lot of pushback, they'll withdraw. But then when the protests die down, I would not be surprised if you see this or other types of encroachment on Hong Kong's autonomy move forward.
Very interesting. So, Olivia, your take on, for now, the fact that things have calmed down, there's been a tactical retreat, but Carrie Lam, who is backed by Beijing, is not going to resign. Actually, some people are concerned if she resigns because the person who might replace her, somebody by the name of Paul Chan, is seen even as more pro-Beijing. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, it seems like the very survival of the city with its limited but very covetous civil liberties and autonomy is at stake.
Yeah, I mean, I agree largely with Daniel that it is concerning that the bill has not been completely shelved. But that being said, I would disagree slightly in that I think that this may be a face-saving measure for Carrie Lam. So I think this is very much so a wait-and-see moment. We have to see whether or not the Hong Kong government is in fact going to reintroduce the extradition bill. There was some suggestion by Carrie Lam that maybe the bill would be reintroduced after she had properly explained to Hong Kong citizens what the thought process was behind it. But I think that it's far more likely that the bill doesn't ever see the light of day again, and that Carrie Lam just doesn't want to have the visual of her saying, yep, I capitulated because these protests took place. So I think it's definitely a wait-and-see moment here, but certainly the demands have changed. You know, the initial protests were just a request for the extradition bill to be withdrawn. Now it's that the bill be completely shelved and that Carrie Lam stepped down. These are new requests. And I think certainly the protesters may be effective in getting their secondary goals, but they also have to be careful about not pressing too much while still defending the freedoms that Hong Kongers hold so dear.
Very interesting. Let's talk about those protesters, Daniel. Who are they? Is it a broad cross-section of Hong Kong, mostly young? How would you characterize them?
My take is it's a much broader cross-section of Hong Kong than in 2014, which was student-led. It's also a much more sort of amorphous group in that there's not sort of a clear leader of this protest movement this time, in part because of the kind of crackdown that happened in 2014. Overall, I mean, I think it's telling that you do have more business men and women participating. In part, I think there's much more concern with the proposed extradition law, in that it really impacts the city's business climate, that if foreign executives have to worry that they might be snatched and extradited to mainland China, they're not going to want to come to Hong Kong. It won't be the kind of global business hub that it used to be. So in that sense, I think a much broader set of societies participating than in the past.
That's very significant. So Olivia, to you, with respect to the protesters, how would you characterize them? And we've been making this comparison between the so-called umbrella movement of 2014, and as Daniel said, that was more student-led. And those demands in 2014 were, you know, they were not agreed to. They were bigger demands about democracy, et cetera, and the ability to vote for the territory's leader. But now, in 2019, we're seeing some success, but a different cross-section.
Yeah, I think that the fact that this is a cross-generational led protest is part of the reason why it has been so successful. A few weeks back, we actually hosted Martin Lee and Nathan Law and a couple of other vocal activists for freedom in Hong Kong. And Martin Lee, of course, was actually the architect of the Basic Law in Hong Kong, which was what was put in place at the time of the British handover. And so I think it's really fascinating because he makes this point that I think is so incredible. Important. There's no rule of law in China, therefore having an extradition law wouldn't mean that rule of law would be in Hong Kong. And there has been rule of law in Hong Kong since the Basic Law, since the handover. And I think that Martin Lee's message is now also being carried and picked up by folks like Nathan Law and Joshua Wong, who was just released from prison. He was actually serving out a 2-month prison term for his involvement and role in the Umbrella Movement. But I think you're seeing this cross-section of society where you have old and young. You have people from diverse backgrounds, businessmen and women, as well as church leaders. You've seen a lot of the Christian community actually coming out and advocating for this. And I think this cross-section demonstrating that inside of China, people are worried that Hong Kong will become like China, that religious liberties will be threatened, that basic ability to express freedom of the press, freedom of association will be threatened, and that this extradition law would mark an incredible turning point towards erosion of freedom rather than toward liberty.
Quickly define the Basic Law for us.
The Basic Law was essentially what administers Hong Kong in this between period from the handover from British rule over to China, and it is what has made Hong Kong this semi-autonomous region that it is today.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Our guests are Daniel Kleiman. He's Senior Fellow and Director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and Olivia Enos. She's a policy analyst in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. We're discussing the roots and ramifications of the massive protests against a controversial extradition bill in Hong Kong. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a big shout out to a loyal listener, Suleiman Kapalwak, who is from the Kakar History Foundation in Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our discussion about the protests in Hong Kong and what they mean. So first to you, Daniel Kleiman, let's talk about Beijing's role here and reaction. To what extent do you think that these protests against the extradition bill took the Hong Kong government and Beijing by somewhat of a surprise?
I think they took both by surprise and certainly created a lot of concern in Beijing. It's quite telling if you look how in mainland China, the state controlled, certainly state curated media ended up covering what was actually occurring in Hong Kong, where essentially you saw only state official media being allowed to report in WeChat and other forms of social media. Even references to Hong Kong were highly censored. And you had massive misinformation for China's domestic audience. Essentially, the Chinese government saying that Hong Kong, there was massive support for this extradition law, that these people were rioters on the streets supported by the sort of the black hands of the United States and others.
Olivia Enos, your take on Beijing's reaction?
I think they definitely took Beijing by surprise. I think they also took Carrie Lam and the Hong Kong government by surprise in large part. But I think there's a trend toward freedom inside of Taiwan. There's a trend toward freedom inside of Hong Kong. But within its own borders, you have millions of individuals, Uyghur Muslims, who are interned. There's somewhere between 800,000 to 1 million, some people say 3 million, in political re-education facilities there. You've seen people of all faith backgrounds, whether they're Tibetan Buddhists, Falun Gong, Christians, Catholics, facing increasing persecution there. And you have seen Beijing really just tamping down in a way that is eerily reminiscent of the Cultural Revolution. And so the contrast between a place like Hong Kong, which actually in Heritage's Index of Economic Freedom ranks number one and has ranked number one for economic freedom since the inaugural report, and then you look inside of Beijing and not only do you not have economic freedom, but you certainly don't have those civil and political liberties that many of us, I think, mistakenly assumed would happen when you had an economic opening there. And so I think it is fascinating to look at this contrast, but also worrisome because, as Daniel mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, we have seen this trend toward eroding freedom and eroding autonomy inside of Hong Kong, where it does look like Beijing is reaching in and trying to erode institutions that have historically been incredibly independent, including the judiciary. And so these are signs and symptoms that we need to watch very closely, and that's why I think we need to so strongly support those voices for freedom like Joshua Wong, like Nathan Law, like Martin Lee, who are standing for freedom in their country.
Well, turning to you, Daniel Kleiman, because Olivia said that we need to support voices for maintaining Hong Kong's status as autonomous and with its civil liberties. So that leads me to ask you, what can other countries do to support these voices? Or is our collective clout somewhat limited given our current trade dispute with China and other things we need from China? How do they strike this balance between standing by Hong Kong but not overly irritating or somehow offending Beijing because they need their help, whether with North Korea or on this trade dispute, etc.?
Sure. So I actually think China will, on the various issues you discussed, including North Korea, pursue its own interests. So whether or not the U.S. and other democracies stand up for the people of Hong Kong, I think China will maintain a hard line in the trade negotiations. It will selectively encourage North Korea to denuclearize. So I actually think in this case, our values and our interests should go hand in hand, where the U.S. and our allies and partners should press hard for sustaining freedom as it exists in Hong Kong. I don't think there'll be negative ramifications in other policy areas. That said, I think we should be realistic that ultimately this is a pretty existential issue for Beijing. The U.S. and its allies and partners, I think, can elevate the focus on what's happening in Hong Kong. They can issue demarches, public statements in various international forums. It doesn't necessarily mean, and I don't think will mean, that Beijing will fundamentally change course. I think it's still very important, though, for us to stand by our values. One other, I would say, policy I think the U.S. and others could pursue is to try to make information on what's happening in Hong Kong more widely available on the mainland, where currently, as I was mentioning before, I think there's a lot of Chinese government-promoted misinformation. And so helping people in mainland China understand that within the Chinese polity, there is a city that is still free and people are standing up for their rights.
How do you see it, Olivia Enos? What would you recommend that countries like the United States or Britain and others do to support Hong Kong and the movement that we're seeing so that they can protect their liberties?
I think that it's really time for the U.S. to start realizing that values and interests are inextricably linked in many ways. And the Trump administration has their free and open Indo-Pacific strategy, and there's a clearly articulated security component to that, a less articulated economic component to that, but also a very clear rhetorical commitment to promoting values in the region. And I think that has largely been on paper and has not really materialized in reality. And so I think it's time for the administration to really put their money where their mouth is and to commit to promoting values there. And I think in Hong Kong in particular, we've seen a lot of congressional leadership. For example, Rubio's staff has introduced the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act.
So Marco Rubio, who's the senator from Florida.
That's right. And a lot of other congressmen, as well as I think Secretary Pompeo, did voice their concern over the extradition law. These were really important statements that were made. But I think that there needs to be a broader recognition that we can use tools that are traditionally used to address national security issues, including sanctions, to hold individuals to account who are responsible for eroding freedom, whether that's in Beijing or even in Hong Kong. For example, we have something called the Global Magnitsky Treasury Authorities that enable us to target particular individuals on human rights and corruption grounds. And we may not be there with Hong Kong, but I think certainly in the Xinjiang case, there are individuals who are known. We have enough information on them that we could directly sanction them and hold them to account. And I think that that's one way that you can integrate some of the values concerns that the U.S. has in a national interest and a national security-based way.
So back to you, Daniel Kleiman. looking at this matter in a larger context, are we seeing a slippery slope whereby Beijing is exerting its prowess and trying to destroy this one country, two system model? And what about the Hong Kong government, which has a more pro-Beijing slant? How does this all work together, and how do you see this playing out?
I think it's extremely difficult for the regime in Beijing to tolerate over the long term a Hong Kong that is autonomous, has a free judiciary, free media. And so, I mean, we've seen this kind of slide in Hong Kong really since after the takeover. So I think you'll see that continue. I mean, I would say certainly the pro-Beijing leadership in Hong Kong, which is to some degree handpicked by Beijing, is acquiescent in this. Clearly, the people of Hong Kong do not want it to move in this direction. I think it's helpful, though, to kind of zoom out. And this is not just an issue for Hong Kong, but a larger issue for how China interacts with a much bigger set of countries, where China more and more is exporting elements of its authoritarian system, often through technology, so technology for surveillance and censorship, to countries not only in the Indo-Pacific, but Africa. And so what you're seeing is not only in Hong Kong, but elsewhere, China beginning to take a more kind of ideological and even purposeful approach to disseminating at least aspects of its system.
So, Olivia, do you see this as a potential slippery slope whereby Beijing, and particularly the leader Xi Jinping, is exerting prowess, trying to, in a sense, erode this one country, two system model, because they see a threat to their very legitimacy, that is, the legitimacy of the communist system?
Yeah, if the extradition law were passed, I think this would be a major mile marker and a major turning point toward really an erosion of liberty in Hong Kong. And I think that we need to continue to take a look at this slippery slope that, as Dan said, is already emerging in Hong Kong, because we have seen over the years already, there were a number of Hong Kong booksellers, for example, one being Lam Wing Kee, who was already kidnapped, essentially, from Hong Kong by Beijing. And there have been countless other people who have been kidnapped by Beijing. So already there is this erosion of liberty that we need to keep close watch on. I think, thankfully, Hong Kong's economy has, for the most part, stayed really free. But again, if this extradition law were to go into effect, you would not have the same freedom. You would not have business people flocking from all over the world to Hong Kong. And so I think we have to be very concerned. And I think that the U.S. government should continue to be vocal in its opposition to such a bill.
So as we close, Daniel Kleiman, what comes next in your view? The protesters have won, in a sense, at least partially. Will they continue to stay in the streets or make their views known? Where do we go from here?
I'd like to end on at least a somewhat optimistic note where, I mean, you do have a lot of, I would say, new people being pulled into this protest movement across Hong Kong, people who are not politically active, who probably stood on the sidelines in 2014. And so hopefully that will translate even in terms of the elections that Hong Kong has for their legislature, that you will have new people going supporting democratic parties that don't want to toe Beijing's line. And so you will see this translated into kind of a more purposeful and long-term political movement that has some electoral power.
You get the last word, Olivia Enos.
I agree with Daniel entirely. I wanted to highlight this one critical point. So the handover is supposed to happen in 2047, if I'm not mistaken. Handover back totally to Beijing, where Hong Kong will be under their auspices. I think the reason why you see so many students involved in this is because they're a generation that is confident that they will be around when this handover takes place. And so the threat to liberty and to their basic freedom, their fundamental way of life, is literally hanging in the lurch. And so I think they see their actions and their activities now as setting a potential precedent and staking a claim, saying we want Hong Kong to remain free, and we don't believe that a Hong Kong where Beijing is strongly involved is one where we necessarily want to live in. And that's an important message, and it's one for all of us to keep in our mind, because 2047 is not that far away.
Well, we will be sure here at the VOA to be following up on this very important issue in the coming months. But for now, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Daniel Kleiman. He's a senior fellow and director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and Olivia Enos, policy analyst in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you both for your absolutely terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin and Kim Lewis. for booking our guests. Our engineer was Joe Gill. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another encounter on The Voice of America.